You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hi, this is Lee Baucom. Welcome to the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast designed to get you the information you need to save your marriage, to change yourself, and to create a new path for your relationship. This is not about just trying to stop a divorce. This is about transforming your relationship and your life in ways that will make you treasure what you have. Each week, we bring to you some more information on how to create some changes in your relationship. The plan we follow is based on my best-selling book, How to Save Your Marriage in Three Simple Steps, that lays out the three C's of saving your marriage. That is to create a connection with your spouse, to change yourself, and create a new path for your relationship. That's how we focus this, one of those three areas. And today, this is a very interesting topic for me because I want to talk about a problem that I think is not well talked about in our society, and it's an issue that I think is going to bother some people. I think it's going to hit home for people, and other people are going to just not want to hear it. So just let me brace you for the fact that this may be something you find offensive. I want to talk about this syndrome that I call PPM, and I'm going to get back to that in just a minute. First, I want to tell you a little self-revelation. I want to tell you about something that came in my life a number of years back. When I was in eighth grade, the summer between my seventh and eighth grade year, my family moved. My father was a pastor, and he chose to go to a different church, and it moved us from a place that was quite an idyllic childhood for me, where I grew up being able to play in the neighborhood and go down to the river with my best friend. And, you know, after we caught some minnows in his stream in his backyard and dug up some worms, we'd head on down to the river and we would fish the new river right underneath the bridge. And so for me, it was kind of an idyllic experience growing up. And then we moved to a place that was not quite so idyllic in my mind. It was not a place where I would choose to be and was a difficult transition point. I moved there between the seventh and eighth grade year, and that also marked the 2 years that were in the junior high. So when I got there, people had already been together for a year, and many of them had been together for their entire childhood. So I was trying to break in, and a piece of my fact is that I'm somewhat of an introvert. And so it's a little more effort on my part to break into those groups. And so I found myself feeling very isolated in that eighth grade year, the beginning of the eighth grade year. And one of the things that happened is I developed a bellyache, a stomach ache. And a couple of times I really felt bad. And so, you know, I went down to the office and they called my mom, and my mom came and she picked me up and took me home and tried to help me with that. And then one day I remember my mother showed up. There I was waiting to be taken home, waiting to be taken out of this difficult situation. And she showed up with medicine. And it was stiff, tough medicine. She gave me a dose of something I don't even know what it is now, but it was the foulest tasting stuff. It was gross. And she said to me, "Now that you've had the medicine, let's wait an hour. And if you're still feeling bad, then you let me know." And her response to that was that we would then have, I would go home, but I would have some more medicine, that this was what I needed. Well, it was tough medicine in lots of ways. And one of the things that I got to the place where I realized that I didn't want to have to take that medicine anymore. But more than that, I realized that what was really going on was I was being anxious. I was feeling anxious, and my anxiety was making my stomach hurt. That was not a lie. But what had happened was I began to use that stomach ache as an excuse to get away from school. Well, my mother was wise enough to know that I couldn't spend my life leaving school early to avoid that. And so she created a circumstance where I actually had to act sick. You know, I was going to have to really take that medicine and live it down. And so from then on, even when my stomach ached, I chose to stay at school, realizing that it wasn't really an illness. It was just my anxiety about being there and that I needed to work through that. Now, that's a lesson that I carry with me today, not perfectly, because we all suffer from this syndrome that I'm describing. PPM syndrome is poor, pitiful me syndrome. It's a syndrome that we all have. That symptom that shows up in lots of different ways. Sometimes we have this belief that something is wrong with me and therefore I'm not responsible for this. You know, we somehow create that place. And you may have heard it many times where people say, well, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm ADD about that, or, you know, I'm just anxious and so that, you know, you got to help me with this, or they make some excuse that leads other people to have to take on the responsibility rather than that person having to work through it. You know, I've heard people proclaim, well, I'm just a controlling person, so deal with it. You know, and what we end up doing is instead of taking a moment to look at ourselves and go, wow, what's going on with me? We claim that symptom and use it as an excuse from responsibility in acting in the world. There are some similar pieces of beliefs that can mark PPM syndrome, the poor pitiful me's. People don't like or understand or get me is another belief that we might hold. People just don't like me. I don't understand. They don't get me. They don't understand me. Or how about the belief that people will say of, well, people just take advantage of me. You know, I'm just a good person and people just take advantage of me. That's just the way it is. Or how about this one? People are just mad at me. I don't know why. People just are mad at me. I can't believe that person's so mad at me. Or how about this one? And this is probably the underlying belief of all PPM syndromes. Life's not fair. Life's unfair. This isn't fair. I don't want this. I don't need this. This just isn't fair. Now, there are some symptoms that show up behind those beliefs. Oftentimes, people who have PPM syndrome are surrounded by drama. They're surrounded and always immersed in that. Their friends are always coming to them with difficulties, or they're having difficulties, or they're finding some way where there's just drama surrounding them wherever they go, whether they're involved in it or peripheral to it. There's just drama all around them. Another symptom is they're focused on the hurts and the slights from others, that other people have hurt them, other people have slighted them, and they're always looking for that place where that somebody else has kind of, to use that country song, done them wrong, right? And so they've been done wrong, and so they get focused on those hurts and the slights from others. Also, just physically, they get focused on their pains and discomfort. You know, the fact is that we all have kind of pains and discomfort, but those who suffer from PPM get focused on those slight pains and hurts, and sometimes get so focused on it that they begin to define themselves by that. Or how about the symptom where they avoid difficulties by involving others in their life? They pull people in. They're having some difficult time in their life, and so they keep pulling other people in as an attempt to get somebody to rescue them, somebody to help them out, somebody to involve themselves in ways that are going to help them find relief. Or how about this? They're involved in indirect communication. Indirect communication is when maybe I have a problem with somebody, but instead of talking to that person, I'll go talk to someone else about it. Or I'll talk to that person, but I'll only hint at it. I won't say what I want or need. I won't say how they've hurt me. I won't be direct with them. I'll be indirect. And so we hint around and we talk about how much we would like something to change, but we don't say, this is what I want you to do. So that indirect communication is a major symptom of somebody suffering from poor pitiful me syndrome, because what they're trying to do is shift the responsibility for being direct onto the other person. Or how about this symptom, that they wait for others to do something that is needed, that something has to be done, but they kind of step back and they expect somebody else is going to take up the slack, going to do it for them, going to pick up the pieces and move forward. That's based in some belief that they don't have to do it, that somebody else will take care of them. So there are some dangers with this syndrome, some pretty serious dangers, I would say. One is that when you are playing poor pitiful me, and by the way, we all do, that we get stuck in viewing ourselves as fragile and that we need protection, that we begin to buy into that. Because if you're playing poor pitiful me and you keep telling yourself that, you begin to believe it. And the view of that is that somehow you're fragile and have to be protected, that somehow you got to make sure that there's, you know, nothing happening that's going to come along and hurt you. Interestingly enough, when we're playing poor pitiful me, while we believe that we're fragile and in need of protection, we're also creating drama all around us in ways that are damaging to ourselves and to the relationships around us. So then another danger is that then other people view us as a victim. Do you know the people where everybody just goes, oh, bless their hearts? That's from the South. So, you know, that's the phrase we use. Bless their hearts. You know, what can happen with this person? Bless their heart. They just can't ever get it together. And life is so unfair. And maybe in the rest of the world, they don't say bless their hearts, but they're saying the same thing. You know, this person just, wow. You know, you just got to look at them and go, wow, how did life get to be so bad for them? And so they're seen as a victim. Now, two things happen when somebody is playing victim. There are some people that get caught up into that, get drawn into it, and they feel a need to help. Those are the rescuers of the world. And so they rush in to help, and they then begin to treat the other person as somebody who has to be rescued. But then there are others who are completely repelled by that behavior, just can't stand it. It might be because it reminds them of somebody in their home or their growing up years. It might be that they just don't want to be pulled into it. Sometimes it's because people have very appropriate boundaries and refuse to be. But in some ways, you find two different groups of people, those who are drawn in to rescue and those who are repelled and refuse to have anything to do with them. So the other thing that ends up happening is that you end up placing yourself in situations that we all, when we're playing Poor Pitiful Me, place ourselves in situations that are going to prove us right, that they're going to prove that we are victims, that we have that cloud following us. We put ourselves in situations where we're going to be the losers and we're going to be hurt. See, this is what's known as confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is the fact that we tend to prove right what we decide we believe. We look for beliefs and proof of our beliefs that show us to be right. Instead of finding something that's contradictory, instead of looking around and noticing the contradictory, we look for the things that prove us right. And that's just our nature of observation. It's a part of our brain that is created to keep us believing that everything is just as the way we believe it. You know, it's kind of like if you go buy a yellow car and then notice all the other yellow cars on the road, or you buy a particular brand and notice all the other brands that are on the road, or you become a fan of a sporting group or a musical group or something, you notice all the other people who are fans of that. It's what we do to keep our life organized. But when it gets down to these beliefs, it can be very dangerous, because what we end up doing is finding support for the beliefs we already have. We don't like to challenge our own beliefs. We look for what helps us continue to believe the same thing. And there's the danger of that confirmation bias, is that once we have begun to believe that we are fragile, that we need protection, that we're the victim here, that we don't have responsibility in it, we begin to look for evidence that only proves us right. Now, I need to make a disclaimer. I want to say that I'm talking about a syndrome around the fact that we often begin to believe ourselves to be victims. But there is a truth that we all get sick. We all have problems. And when we are sick or we have problems, we do need support. But there are times when problems and feeling poorly just become excuses and we get stuck in that role. It's not whether we're going to sometimes be playing the poor, pitiful me role, but whether we get stuck in that role. And that's the nature of any role we play in our personal life, in our family life, in our professional life. Is it's not that there might not be some roles we step into. It's can we step out of those roles, or do we get stuck in that role? So the problem here is not whether sometimes you're sick or you have problems and you need help. It's the fact that sometimes people get stuck in a pattern where they're always stuck in that role. They're always playing sick. They're always playing victim. They're always seeing themselves as being unable to get beyond that. So just to make it clear, there are times that we all are going to play poor, pitiful me, and we are going to deserve to play that. When you're sick, you need somebody to take care of you. When you have a crisis, it's nice to have somebody to help you along. The danger is when that begins to identify us, that we begin to be stuck in that role, unable to be anything other than that. I have noticed that sometimes there are groups of people that even when they are sick, they are looking for what are my possibilities at this point, not what are my limits. And we can play even when we have a crisis or an illness, the question of what are my possibilities, or we can look at, oh gosh, I have no possibilities. I'm so limited. I can't do these things. And we forget the capacity we have of doing things even in those difficult moments. Okay, so let me talk about some assumptions I have just about life. First, I believe that bad things happen to everyone, that there's nothing endemic to the fact that something bad happens to you, that there's something wrong with you. That really is, to talk about one of those bumper stickers, poop happens to all of us. Bad stuff just happens. It's just the way life happens. There are laws of physics and there are laws of, you know, our own health. You know, we are, as I often talk about, we are on a terminal course from the day we're born. And so bad things are going to happen. We are going to lose people around us. We are going to have health issues. We are going to have places where life doesn't go the way we want it to. But another assumption is, so do good things. Good things just happen to people just because we show up and we're in the world. That's just the way it is. The fact that we were born, that's a good thing right off the bat. The fact that we find great people in our life, that's a good thing. So good things and bad things both happen to everyone. We all get sick. We all suffer misfortune. We all suffer loss. We all have those bumps in the roads. You know, that's the thing about existence that kind of brings it down to everybody. Everybody is going to suffer loss at some time. Everybody is going to have some health issues at some time. Everybody is going to have some misfortune. It's just the nature of life. So the question here is whether we have an acute case of poor pitiful me syndrome or a chronic case of poor pitiful me. The difference between the two is this. Acute is what our response is immediately after some kind of loss. Immediately after there's some misfortune or there's some illness or something happened to us, it's pretty natural for us to have a natural reaction of, wow, man, this is horrible. I feel so bad. And that's the acute case of poor pitiful me. But then there's the chronic case. The chronic case is when we begin to use that role of poor pitiful me as a method of interacting with the world, of a way of being in the world, of seeing ourselves as being, having problems and being weak and having difficulties and being incapable of taking care of ourselves. And when we have that, then it becomes chronic. And the difference between the two is primarily one piece. Chronic cases are aimed at getting attention from other people and disavowing responsibility for ourselves. Acute cases are simply a reaction to loss. It's a natural reaction to loss to say, wow, poor pitiful me. I couldn't see that coming. I can't believe that person died or that person left me or I have to suffer this loss. That's just an acute case. But chronic is when we begin to use that as a way of seeking attention. And I know this is where it begins to be hard to hear of how we're playing that role, but it's when it becomes about seeking attention and disavowing personal responsibility. How we make that pattern a way of saying, this is not my fault. I have no responsibility in this. I have no way of dealing with this. Now, here's the danger of that poor pitiful me syndrome. It's easy for it to become habitual. When I was in eighth grade, did my stomach hurt? It absolutely did. But then I saw that it helped alleviate something else in my life, and it began to take on a whole nother habitual level. It's not like I sat there and thought, you know what, if I say my stomach hurts, my mom will come and I won't have to deal with this anymore. But that is the effect I learned. That's the pattern I learned. And so it was beginning to be habitual until my mother gave me some pretty yucky medicine that I had to choke down and recognize that maybe that wasn't the solution. Another danger is that it reinforces a belief in the weakness of the self, that we begin to believe that we are weak, we're incapable of doing things, that the belief of weakness begins to lead us. Creates a belief that life is unfair and that others don't suffer from this same thing, that I'm the one who has the unfair life and everybody else has some exception to it. Now, this is kind of that place where we are all most aware of our own losses and often miss the fact that there are others around us that are suffering losses and suffering difficulties. We just don't see it because we're playing out our own personal drama in our own head. We're creating the script that leads us to look for those who will take responsibility, that leads us to look for ways that we don't have to be responsible for all of that in our life. And that script is what trips us up. That script is what keeps us stuck and what becomes habitual and then reinforces that belief in the weakness of ourself. We don't see how much capacity we have because we wrap ourselves up into this weakness mindset. The capacity of seeing that it's just about me being poor, pitiful me, instead of the capacity we have to take responsibility and move forward with life. So what happens when the poor, pitiful me syndrome gets in a marriage? Let's talk about that for a minute. There are really two basic effects that happen when somebody is playing poor, pitiful me, of what that does with a spouse. People will often find, when they're playing poor, pitiful me, someone who will take care of them and rescue them. That's just kind of that nature of life, that there are people that we find an attraction to, a valence to, a connection with. And sometimes that's because of the fit, and it's not always a healthy fit. So people with poor, pitiful me syndrome will find someone who will actually take care of them and rescue them and like to do that. But there are two effects that come out of that. The first one is that the rescuer and the rescued relationship, that relationship between the two, the rescuer and the rescue, or the rescuer and the victim, that relationship is always unequal and unbalanced. There is a built-in inequality to it because somebody can't take care of themselves and the other person takes care of themselves and somebody else. And this can create a caretaker and a cared for relationship that easily slips into a parent-child relationship. Now, I'm not talking here about a spouse who has to take care of someone who is ill, or how spouses sometimes come together where one of them might be weak in an area and the other is strong. That's not what I'm talking about, because when somebody is weaker in an area and somebody is strong and they put that together, that's just playing to their strengths, unless somebody else is playing the role of being weak in everything and the other has to be strong in everything. And then at that point, we've crossed into this area of the rescuer and the victim. But in a normal relationship, when somebody gets sick, the other person takes care of them. When somebody's having a hard time, the other person steps in to step up the game. So that's a normal part of the relationship. And this is more about the acute poor, pitiful me that might come in, or acute stage of a crisis that might come into a relationship. What we're really talking about is when that type of behavior is not just acute, but it's chronic. When somebody is always playing the role of, I can't do this, this isn't my responsibility, it's not my fault, or you need to fix my world, you need to make me okay. When that happens, that's when the imbalance comes in. That's when the unequal imbalance comes in and can easily slip into that parent-child relationship. Now, the problem with the parent-child relationship is it is always unequal, that somebody is always having to take on more responsibility. But more than that, somebody's going to outgrow it. Either the parent or the child is going to outgrow it. So that leads to the second problem and the second effect in a marriage, is that the rescuer might one day tire of that role and decide to leave it, or at least to leave that portion of the relationship. There comes a point when somebody says, you know what, I'm tired of always being the one to clean up. I'm tired of always being the one to rescue. And so sometimes they say, I'm not going to do that anymore. In that sense, they've actually outgrown the role of rescuer. Now, it's also possible that the person who has been playing poor, pitiful me outgrows that role, and then the other person who has been the rescuer suddenly has no role there. You see how that can work either way. Either person can one day say, I'm done with this role, and the other person is suddenly lost without a role, is suddenly lost without a role that is functioning anymore and is no longer able to know what to expect, to know what's coming. And suddenly when that happens, a crisis develops in the relationship because neither one know the new rules. They only know that one person is tired of the old rules, but the other person is used to the old rules and continues to want to play and continues to try to pull in the other person into those old rules and old roles and old games. And when that happens, there ends up being a fairly substantial marriage crisis. Now, when a couple stays in that rescuer-victim relationship, it may avoid being a marriage crisis, but is tiring and is dysfunctional in itself. So while the relationship may stay in that dysfunction over time, it begins to tear at the fabrics of each person, as one person is constantly not having to take responsibility and the other person is having to constantly be responsible, not just for themselves, but also with the other person. And in that sense, there is a trouble that gets marked. So what is the antidote to this poor, pitiful me syndrome? I want to talk some about the antidote and how we get around it by first saying that poor, pitiful me syndrome is something that most of us don't want to admit to. That most of us have some level of that, infection in our life, and yet we don't want to claim that. Nobody wants to think about the fact that maybe they're playing the poor, pitiful me game. And so let me just suggest that instead of thinking, am I like that, to ask, how am I like that? How might I fit into that role? Or am I playing the role of rescuer? Is more about how am I playing the role of rescuer? Because we all have symptoms here. We all have places where poor, pitiful me gets in there. It's just part of our human nature of being very aware of the pain in our own life. So the first antidote to this poor, pitiful me syndrome is a self-diagnosis. To self-diagnose where you play that role. Now, I've got to be clear, nobody's going to like thinking through that process. I don't like thinking about how I play those roles sometimes. I don't like thinking about how I might shift responsibility to somebody else, not take responsibility for myself. And yet, I know that we all do that. So a self-diagnosis is an important part of the process of being able to say, how am I playing this poor, pitiful me syndrome out? How am I playing the role of victim in my own life? Followed with a second question of asking, how chronic is it? In other words, how much of my life is infected by this poor, pitiful me syndrome? Does it get to all of my life or just parts of my life? Do I rescue everybody around me or just a few people here and there? Do I play irresponsible or non-responsible? That's a better term of non-responsible in my life. Or is it only here and there? Recognize that we all use excuses to remove responsibility where we might take on responsibility. So asking that question of how chronic is it lets you know how much you need to combat this infection, how much you need to combat this chronic phase of everybody of playing poor, pitiful me. The poor, pitiful me syndrome is not about somebody having it. It's that we all have a slight infection of it, that we all can do a better job of saying, how can I take on responsibility? Which requires another piece of the antidote of changing beliefs. When we are stuck in the place of thinking that life is unfair, that we're the ones who are getting picked on, then we're going to play out the role of victim. We're going to play out the role of how could this possibly be about me and my responsibility? So we have to change in beliefs. And one of those central beliefs is to say, how can I accept responsibility for my entire life? So let me pause here and say again that responsibility is not the same as blame. When I say, how do you take responsibility for your life? It's how do you deal with what life throws your way? How do you deal with the good stuff? How do you deal with the bad stuff? How do you deal with what is coming your way just because that's how life works? So a change of belief is saying, I can be responsible for all parts of my life. That doesn't mean that I created all the things that happened, but I can choose how I will respond to what life sends my way. I have the ability to be responsible. Responsible is able to respond and saying, how can I respond differently to what's coming at me? So part of the antidote is being able to step back and say, I am going to accept responsibility for where life is and how I move through it. Now, there's a recent idea. Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote the book, Anti-Fragile. And in that book, he was looking at how systems really come in three different layers. There are systems, and when I mean systems, I'm including people in that because people are built in systems of personality and even biology, but also systems like the banking system that Nassim was looking at or world politics, all these systems that are built with different components. And he said that they come in three different ways. There are those that are fragile. And the ones that are fragile will break when there's something pushed against them. And so there's a need to protect that system. He also says there are things that are sturdy, and those are just things that won't break. You know, if you think of like a rock is not something you have to protect, but it's just a sturdy thing. You throw it down, it's not going to break, likely not going to break. And then there is what he calls anti-fragile, which is something that is hardened by adversity, a system that is hardened by the adversity that comes its way instead of seeing it as something that will be broken by what comes its way. It sees itself as something that will gain from it. Now, this really matches my own schema of how I understand thriving. When I put out this idea of thriving, I started by talking about parenting, that we have different ways of parenting. And one way is to treat children as fragile, that they have to be protected, and we have to make sure that nobody bothers them and that nothing bad happens. And part of that fragile mindset in parenting is where our school system is now and where this whole self-esteem movement is now, where you have to make sure that kids always feel positive about themselves, that no harm can come. And helicopter parenting is one place where you see a treatment of kids as if they are fragile and they might break. And then there's a possibility of parenting in a way that says that children will bounce when they are taught to bounce, that children can bounce back from things, can learn the skills to bounce back. And so I want to add a second part to that, which is thriving. How can people thrive? By looking at what is a challenge, by not just getting to kind of a point in time where everything's okay. And so a fragile idea, a fragile person would see themselves as, if something comes my way, I'm just not going to be able to handle it and I'm going to fold. A resilient person would see it as, okay, I had something bad that happens. Now I've got to get back to normal, kind of the old place. But a thriving person recognizes that when a challenge comes, not only can you get back to normal, but you can get a step above. You can learn from that. You can grow from that. That everything in life that allows us to grow is based on something that stretches us. I was talking with someone just a few weeks ago that said, you know, I really want to work on being patient. And I said, well, that means you're going to have to look for the opportunities to practice patience. Not hoping that the world's going to stop sending you stuff that makes you be patient. That's not learning patience. That's avoiding things that make you impatient. But when we want to learn patience, we take on the times when we feel impatient and teach ourselves to be patient. That's taking something that's pushing against us and learning from it, growing from it. When we watch difficulties come our way and we decide that we can grow beyond it, not just to the point back to normal, but to actually thrive into it, then we are, in a lot of ways, suddenly taking full responsibility for our life. Not just that, but growing beyond where we've ever been before to a higher level of development. And that's about thriving. Anti-fragile is the term that Nassim Taleb puts in, but I put that as thriving. That when we get to the place where we realize that it's not a matter of, is this going to break us? Or can I get back to normal? It's, how can I take this challenge and go to a whole new place? And so I would suggest that we all have a place of leaving behind that mindset of poor, pitiful me, and we ask ourselves three questions. One is, how do I challenge myself? How do I look for the places where I can take on a challenge? How do I look for the things that are coming my way in life and decide I'm going to let that be a challenge to myself, to grow, to find new parts of myself, to learn new ways of being? So the question is, how do I challenge myself? Can I find new ways of challenging? Second is, where are the opportunities for growth in any difficulty or setback? And this is a real challenge, to begin to think that anything that's tough that comes our way has an opportunity for growth in it, has a place for learning in it, that when the things are the hardest, we have the most to learn. When something comes our way, whether it's a challenge at work or a challenge in a relationship or a challenge in our health or a challenge in life, we have something we can learn from it. And to ask the question, where are the opportunities for growth in this difficulty or in this setback, gives you a place to grow from. It gives you a new place. Instead of saying, poor, pitiful me, it gives us the opportunity of saying, who am I going to be when this is over that's better than I was before, that's functioning at a whole different place than I was before? And the last question is, how can I take more responsibility for my life? How can I rise to the place where I say, how am I going to be more responsible with what's coming my way? How can I decide to be responding differently instead of just saying, you know, I'm a victim here? I had no way of reacting to that in any other way than the way I reacted, to ask the question, how can I respond differently? How am I able to respond differently to the situation and take responsibility for my life instead of trying to hand that off to somebody else? How can I take responsibility for my life instead of assuming the responsibility for others around me? So those are the three questions I want you just to kind of ponder as we all do a little growing and we all escape our poor, pitiful me is, how do I challenge myself? Where are the opportunities for growth in any difficulty or setback? And how can I take more responsibility for my life? Recognize that these pieces fit into how we can move into a new relationship in a marriage, how we can escape the roles of poor, pitiful me and go to a whole new place of partnership. A whole new place of responsibility. And if you've been somebody who is dealing with somebody who plays poor, pitiful me, how can you step back and allow them to take responsibility for life in ways that are growth enhancing for them, not just getting in your way, but have a place for you to say, we are partners in this. Let's draw on both of our strengths. Let me be responsible for what I need to be responsible for, and let you be responsible for what you need to be responsible for. And that way, we all get to grow into a partnership that works for everyone. Okay, I hope this has been helpful. I would love to know your thoughts. You can do that a couple of ways. One is you can leave a comment in the area below just to let me know what you thought about this, what you thought about this idea, whether it really bothered you, whether you identify with it. You may say, well, I identify, but I'm the rescuer. And you may say, wow, I identify with it, and I've got to figure out how to stop playing poor, pitiful me. So leave that if you're on the blog. Leave that in the comments area below. If you've got some questions that came out of this, you'd like to hear more about this, please drop me an email at podcast@savethemarriage.com. That's podcast@savethemarriage.com. And that way we can all continue this conversation together as we all work to take more responsibility, to be able to respond to life every day more and more so that we're thriving in new ways as we take on those challenges. I wish you the best.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.